Hello.
Hello.
Fran, this is Tig. I'm sorry about the technical difficulties.
Well, I'm sure it's not your fault.
It is not, but I take full responsibility.
No, that's a very bad habit.
Okay. I had nothing to do with it, but I still feel terrible that you were having to deal with that.
Yes. Well, I accept your depression over it, but I know it's not your fault. I'm not surprised because nothing works.
This is Don't Ask Tig. I'm Tig Notaro, and today I invite you to pretend this is a legit advice podcast. I'm so pleased to be joined by writer and quintessential New Yorker, Fran Lebowitz. Fran, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
People have no idea what it took to get you here on this show.
Nor would they care.
They really don't, but I'm always open for a long, boring story. Fran, we have something in common, and it's that we're both high school dropouts who earned our GEDs.
No, I'm not a dropout. I was thrown out.
Oh, you were thrown out?
Yes.
Oh, well, congrats to you. I think they tried to throw me out a few times, but my parents made me keep going back. Is your GED a point of pride? That you've managed to succeed without a formal high school education, or?
Well, you know, I actually had, at the time I took it, which was literally thousands of years ago, they gave me a certificate, which in the last time I moved, I believe I found it, and then it disappeared again. So luckily, I've never been asked to show it anywhere. It was of no use to me whatsoever.
I have had the same experience. Mine's slightly different in that, and I know this sounds untrue, but my cat ate my GED.
And well, it was probably more beneficial to the cat than it was to you.
Probably. What is left of my GED is framed and hanging on my wall in my office. May I ask how you got thrown out of school? Or
you may ask. I don't have a real answer for you because I went to public school my whole life, and then I went to private school because the public school told my parents that I would never get into college if I stayed in that school where I was failing everything. So I went to a private school. It was an all-girls Episcopalian school. Mm. All private schools when I was that age were either girls' schools or boys' schools. I went to this school, and when I got thrown out, a letter came from the headmaster saying that they had to throw me out of the school because I was a very bad influence on the other girls, and I was usurping the power of the headmaster.
Mm.
And by the way, my parents didn't do a single thing about it. When I was young, if the school punished you in some way, your parents then punished you again. They never took your side.
Your parents never took your side?
Not just my parents. No one's parents did. If the school said you did something wrong, the parents agreed with the school.
Oh, okay.
It was a completely different world. It had nothing to do, really, specifically with my parents, who also never took my side. But
was just the time.
Yeah, it was the era. I mean, if the school said something, then that was it.
Well, I had a wild mother who, although she sent me back to school, she supported the mischief that I got into from time to time, and she got kicked out of school, too. So kind of runs in my family. But I do stand-up comedy.
I know that.
Some people don't recognize it as that. But in listening to you and watching you, which, by the way, I love your Netflix series.
Thank you.
Your conversational observations can sometimes feel very similar to stand-up. Do you feel that?
I myself would never have thought of it, except that people often say this to me. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't seem that way to me because I know a number of comedians, and one thing I know about all the comedians I know is they write their acts. You know, that means they have to sit down and write it in some way, or they have to at least think about it. I don't think about this at all. You know, someone asks me something and I answer it. The difference, of course, you know, when you stand up, you come out on the stage and you start. No one asks you a question. So that makes it very different. I never thought about it. I never thought about being a comedian. I never wanted to be a comedian. I love stand-up. I used to go all the time and watch it all the time. It's my favorite form of entertainment. But I never thought about being one.
And what stand-ups have you enjoyed over the years?
Well, I mean, I've seen a billion people, really. But I haven't seen people lately, I have to say that. But I have to say, in case you were going to ask me this, by far the best person I ever saw, so much better than everyone else, even though there are a lot of great stand-ups, was Richard Pryor. I mean, I never saw anyone even close to him. And the last time I saw him, he was played at Town Hall in New York. And it was after he was in that accident, you know, that burning accident. And I would say the audience was at least half comedians.
Oh, I'm sure.
Maybe more. And, you know, it's my belief that most people, especially comedians, are very competitive with each other. But my feeling was talking to a lot of these people was just like, no one thought that way about Richard Pryor because after all, it's Richard Pryor, you know, we're not going to be that good.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he's still thought of as the number one greatest comedian of all time.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, he's certainly the greatest one I saw. Even when he was not that great, like compared to other times where he was greater, he was still better than anyone else.
Yeah. My brother and I were both very big fans of his all through childhood, and I loved his movies. And I was oddly, his family asked me to write the foreword for his book when they reissued it. And that was kind of a nerve-wracking experience because I do really think so much of him. And he just really inspired me. Now, you dedicated Pretend It's a City, your Netflix documentary series, to the writer Toni Morrison. And you once said, quote, "I've known a lot of smart people in my life, but I only ever knew one wise person, and that is Toni." Since this is an advice show, is there any particular piece of wisdom or advice from Toni you could share?
I'm trying to think. I mean, a lot of the advice Toni gave me was, you know, very specific advice to Fran. And that is, I mean, when this epidemic first started, I mean, of course, I miss Toni all the time. She was really one of my closest friends for over 40 years. But when the epidemic started, of course, it was something that happened that I never thought about happening. And Toni's editor, who's also my editor, called me and he said, "Don't you miss Toni right now? Much worse." I said, "Yes." He said, "Why?" I said, "Because I don't know how to think about this. You know, I don't know how to feel about this. I don't know how to think about this." And Toni, even though Toni was, you know, pretty old, she wasn't old enough to have lived through the 1918 flu epidemic. And so I said, "I don't know how to think about this at all." And Toni would know how to think about it. He said, "You're right, Toni would know how to think about it." But so it took me forever to figure out how to think about this because I knew if Toni was alive, she would have told me right away, even though she had never lived through it. You know, wisdom is a thing people talk about a lot, but I don't think most people have an opportunity to encounter it because, you know, it's so rare that in my life, and I am old, and I've known a billion people, I encountered it exactly once.
Wow. Yeah.
It wasn't just, you know, intelligence or brilliance. You know, Toni was brilliant, but truthfully, I know other brilliant people. It had something to do with the kind of humanity Toni had, which was so much bigger than anyone else's humanity, not just mine, which is, you know, not notably gigantic. it had to do with this kind of empathy that she had, even for terrible people. Not that she liked them or she excused them, but she understood them. And she understood that you're really better off trying to understand them instead of just dismissing them, which I do with almost everybody. And if you read Toni, you see that even in her characters who are, you know, I would have to say some of them evil. She still sees them as humans. And that must be some aspect of wisdom, although I am not an expert on wisdom.
Yeah, it's definitely a large conversation that is taking place about dismissing people with everything that's going on. And then the popular phrase, cancel culture. But it makes me want to go back and read more of Toni's stuff because it's probably a better idea to be compassionate or try and find some understanding.
You know what it was? My mother used to say to me all the time when I was a kid, can't you be the bigger person? And truthfully, it turns out I can't. It turns out that I am by nature the smaller person. And I never really understood it till I knew Toni, because she was the bigger person.
Yeah.
But it's not a thing that I don't believe you acquire this. I think it is a matter of inborn character. I know you're not allowed to say that because everything's supposed to be achievable, but, you know, everything is not achievable.
Another thing that you did say of New York, that it contained, quote, a density of angry homosexuals, which is always good for a city. Do you care to explain that?
But doesn't that seem truthful on his face?
I think so. I'm curious what your thoughts are, or just any extra feelings you might have.
I don't know. I don't remember in what context I said that, you know, but, and I also know you're not supposed to say homosexual anymore, but I really can't keep up with everything. So
you're not supposed to say homosexual?
I thought you weren't, but people who are homosexual or whatever it is you're supposed to say are not as angry as they used to be. So I was talking about when I was young, when I first came to New York.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was like in 1970. So it was really a long time ago. And New York was packed with angry homosexuals. And of course it's good for a city. It's not good for the homosexual. You know, I mean, here's the problem. Oh, here's one of the problems. Things that are good for the culture are not the same things that are good for society. You know, all the tremendous progress that's been made, which is really not just tremendous, but would have been unfathomable to me, and not just to me, to anyone, has been very good for humanity, for the society, but not so great for the culture. I mean, you know, people used to say, why are so many great artists homosexual? People would say that all the time, you know, like it was some, you know, mystery. I mean, it never seemed like a mystery to me. You know, why were, you know, in the beginning, in the middle, say, of the 20th century, most American comedians were Jewish. Then most comedians or many comedians were black. Comedians were very rarely upper class, straight male WASPs. I mean, now being an artist, you know, is like a desirable occupation, you know, profession, like being a doctor or something. You know, people even go to school to do it, like you could learn these things. But throughout most of history, a person who was an artist was a person who was not in the center, you know, of the establishment. And that is what causes a person to observe, you know, rather than participate. And homosexuals were forced to observe all the time, not choose to, but forced to, you know, among, you know, many other reasons that made everyone angry. So that's the anger part. You know, the artist part is you're observing. You have to. If you feel endangered, you have to watch. That's what creates a culture.
And do you feel now that the homosexuals in New York are not as angry, how do you feel like it's affected the city?
Well, it's not just in New York. I mean, first of all.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Yeah. But first of all, people would come to New York just because they were gay. Because you could live here. You know, you could have a life here. You know, now you can live anywhere. You can live in the suburbs. You can live next door to straight people who before that would have killed you or, you know, I mean, and it's not that there are more gay people, I don't think. You know, I think that there are more people who feel they can say it. You know, it's when people write about people before, like 5 minutes ago, and criticize them for being in the closet is so angering to me because everyone was. You know, because you had to be. And I don't mean when we used to say someone was in the closet when I was young, we meant to us, to other gay people, you know, but to straight people, if you felt like being employed or actually being able to rent an apartment, that would be what everyone did. And I don't think people are aware of this, people who are young. And I'm not saying they should be aware of it, but they should then resist making blanket statements.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I just turned 50 and I am certainly not somebody that was on the front lines of the gay movement or in the completely closeted era of time, but I've certainly seen things evolve since the 90s and my wife is 15 years younger than me and it's a world that she can't comprehend at all. Especially, I mean, I was in Texas and Mississippi and places like that. I mean, luckily my family is open and accepting, but the surrounding areas and people were not on the same page. So it's still an unusual thing to feel so, to be able to be so open, because I didn't feel I could years ago.
But let me assure you, I was not on any front lines. I never participated. Lots of times kids come up to me in the street and they thank me. Thank you for your activism. Thank you for, you know, gay marriage. And I thought, honey, let me assure you that I had nothing to do with any of this. You know, first of all, in New York, you know, it was called the Gay Liberation Movement. Uh-huh. It struck me as ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous. I never thought in a million years it would change.
Uh-huh.
And I also had no interest in changing it, because once I got to New York, I was so happy. I didn't care, you know, and it was also considered maybe more of a San Francisco thing. And also it was considered not really a very stylish thing, I would have to say. I didn't fight for it. I never heard of gay marriage. It didn't exist in anyone's idea. I never heard anyone mention it. I never heard anyone express that they thought about it. It would never even occur to me. You know, it was somewhat surprising to me, I have to say, until I really understood everything that, you know, was going on in regard to this, that the two things that people fought for the most, you know, marriage and being able to join the military. It's like, are you kidding me? These are the two most confining institutions on the planet Earth. Why would you ever want to be involved in these things? And when people say they want to get married, I always say, really? Before you get married, I'm going to ask you something. Have you ever met anyone who was married? So it's like, I never fought for this. I never wanted it. It never even occurred to me. So I'm not against it. I don't, you know, probably not the greatest thing I could say about myself. I don't care that much about what other people do. You want to get married? Fine. Get married. I don't care. You know, I really don't care. But it never occurred to me. It never occurred to me that was a desirable thing. And joining the army still seems to me like a total a thing. Like, I can't believe they get anyone to do this. I don't know how they get people to do this. When I was young, there was a draft, you know.
Right.
And that was one of the few upsides of being a girl when I was young, was that only boys got drafted. There was also a war, an actual war, although now we have a million wars that never end. And you were not allowed into the army if you were gay. But very few people got out of the army that way, because if you did, you also then never got a job.
Right. Yeah, I would never want to join the military. And I felt similarly to you. I didn't understand the appeal of marriage, and I had no interest, but I have to say I obviously caved after I met Stephanie. So I am married, but I will not thank you for anything.
It's absolutely, I had nothing to do with it, believe me.
Oh my gosh. I would give anything to see that conversation, or any of those conversations that happened where somebody thanked you for all that you've done and you told them you did nothing. If there's nothing. Footage of that anywhere, please send it to me.
Less than nothing.
Well, Fran, I've got listeners with problems. Will you help me help them?
Well, I'll try.
Okay. I will too. That's all I ever do. Our first question comes from a listener worried about her independence. Emily writes, "My roommate is getting married and will soon be moving out of our apartment and the state. I will be living on my own for the first time. Any tips on how to make this transition easier? We've lived together for almost 7 years, and I'm nervous about living on my own and also without her." I'm smirking as I'm reading that, because there's a part of me where I can only imagine what you're going to say, and I can't imagine. Or maybe you have nothing to say. That's the other thing that's amusing.
Well, first of all, I have lived alone my entire life.
I assume.
I have never lived with anyone else. And probably that is, for a lesbian, the greatest accomplishment of my life. So I have never had the slightest desire to live with anyone. I never had a roommate when I was young, and I had absolutely no money. I lived in an apartment, you know, the size of, you know, like it was 10 by 12. It was horrible.
Uh-huh.
In fact, when I was young and all my friends were young and no one had any money, most people did live by themselves, unless they lived with, you know, a girlfriend or a boyfriend or something.
Uh-huh.
Roommates were not that big a thing. I mean, I can't even think of anyone I knew had a roommate. But I can't understand why everyone doesn't live alone. You know, at the beginning of the lockdown of the pandemic, this friend of mine sent me like $8 million worth of orchids with a note. You know, I hope this keeps you company during the lockdown. And I called him and I said, are you out of your mind? The only way, my feeling was, how are people who live with other people going to get through this? You know, having to be in an apartment with someone else, you know, when you can't really leave the apartment, seemed to me just unendurable. So I would say to Emily, you are very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to think to yourself, how did I ever live with her all those years?
I think I have a great idea, Fran. I think you should take the leap finally and get a roommate and maybe move in with Emily.
This will never happen.
I can't imagine what a difficult roommate you would be.
I would be such a... I never even thought about that. Of course, I would be unendurable.
It would be the worst possible thing because you have never had to compromise or negotiate with anybody around any part of living together. And already people that, I mean, of course, I'm assuming you lived with your family as a child, but none of that matters when you move in with a roommate or a partner or spouse. And so I can't even imagine. That would be an incredible reality show. And I'm saying
that will never happen.
Come on, Fran. The world would love to see you finally move in with a roommate.
That would never happen. And my interest in what the world would love is not even zero.
Why it's even better. You could tell everyone, just yell at them to turn the cameras off. The whole thing would be such a joy. I know you don't care what brings us joy, but that's what the people want to see.
Yeah, well, they'll have to find some other form of entertainment because that won't happen. But I am pretty sure, not knowing Emily, that Emily will discover how blissful it is to not have another person in your apartment.
Emily, thank me later for your new roommate, Fran Lebowitz. All right, we'll be back with more questions after the break. Okay, we are back. Fran, our next question is from a listener who wants some space. Peter writes, if I get the opportunity to travel to Mars, should I go even though it's probably a one-way trip? I know it's unlikely. There probably won't be a lot of demand for middle-aged English teachers with food allergies when the time comes to colonize Mars. Still, I spend a lot of time worrying about this. I just found out that, do you know about that, that a trip to Mars is one way?
Space travel is something that I know almost nothing about, but it seems totally reasonable to me that a trip to Mars would be one way.
I don't know anything about it, but talking to you, that's a new thing. I want to see you go to Mars.
Yeah, I am not going to Mars. But I'm pretty sure that someone who's middle-aged would be dead before they got to Mars, because doesn't it take quite a long time? It's like even further than Australia.
It is further than Australia.
If this was at all a serious question, which strikes me as unlikely, I would say that I would love to have so few problems that this would be something bothering me.
I mean, what else can I say? That's true, Fran. Peter, thanks for writing in. Let us know what you decide. Fran, our next question is very simply stated, but I don't think it has a simple answer. Iris writes, how can I be funnier?
You can't be.
I was going to say, just writing into an advice show with that question, Iris, I'm sad to say there is no hope.
No.
There's just no hope for you.
She should concentrate on something else.
Yeah.
Maybe plan your trip to Mars.
Write us back and let us know how it's going. Just make sure it's funny when you write us, Iris. Fran, before I let you go, I have one more thing I'd like to ask you. Well, I guess it's two more things. What is the best advice you've ever received, and what's the worst advice you've ever received? And you can't say the worst advice was to go on my show.
No, that certainly would not be the worst advice. I would say that all the worst advice I've ever received, and I'm not going to be specific, has been from lawyers. So not only have I received terrible advice from lawyers, but of course you also then pay for that advice. So I would say basically the best advice I could give is, unless you can absolutely not avoid it, never call a lawyer.
All right. There it is. Fran, we've reached the end of the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
Do you have anything that you would like to promote aside from not caring?
I actually do not.
Well, I'm going to promote your Netflix series. It's such a fun, enjoyable, interesting watch. I'm so, so thrilled that you made that. So there, I promoted that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Appreciate you taking the time, and I'm sorry for the technical difficulties I had nothing to do with.
I am well aware of that, and thank you.
Are you enjoying the show? If so, give us a rating or review on the Apple Podcast Store. It's easy to do, and you can do it right now. What are you waiting for? Seriously, why are you waiting? Do it, and tell a friend about the show. If you think they like it, or even if you think they won't like it, tell them, and tell them to review the show. What are you waiting for? Do it. Don't Ask Tig is hosted by me, Tig Notaro. It's produced by Thomas Ouellette, Shayna Deloria, and Ryan Lohr. Our editors are Phyllis Fletcher and Beth Perlman. Executive producer, Lauren D. Engineering and sound mixing by Johnny Vince Evans and Eric Romani. Digital production by Christina Lopez. Talent booking by Marianne Ways. Production support from Pizza Shark. Our theme music is Friend in Tig by Edie Burkell and Kyle Crusham. And Listen to Your Heart by Edie Burkell. Special thanks to Hunter Seidman, Lily Kim, and Alex Shafford. Concept developed by Tracy Mumford. Our executive consultant is Dean Capello and Gobsmack Studios. You can always ask for advice at don'asktig.org. Just write in with your problem or send us a voice memo. You can also follow us on social media at Don't Ask Tig. Don't Ask Tig is a production of American Public Media. And as always, thanks, Dana, and I'll tell Becky. That's what you